It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, wearable fitness trackers are popular, but some recent studies have found that they don't necessarily lead to being more active or to losing weight. We'll try to get a handle on why. First, FBI Director James Comey testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee today. For the first time, he publicly confirmed that the FBI is investigating an alleged collusion between Russia and President Donald Trump's campaign in the 2016 election.
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
Eric Geller joins us now to talk about the hearing and what else Comey revealed. He's a cybersecurity expert for Politico Pro. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what did you make of James Comey's public confirmation of this investigation into Russian influence on the U.S. elections?
Well, look, I think it's fair to say that the investigation itself was sort of the worst-kept secret in Washington. Everybody knew that this was happening. There have been, you know, tons of leaks about it. I think what's significant is that Director Comey went to the Justice Department and said, apparently said, you know, look, we've got to tell them something. You know, there's a media firestorm around this. What can we say? And the Justice Department, in this case, headed by the acting Deputy Attorney General, because the Attorney General has recused himself, the Justice Department said, yeah, here's what you can say. We want to put this out there. We want to make sure the public knows. I mean, this is almost a surreal situation just in terms of how unprecedented it is. And I think it speaks to the fact that everybody involved, especially Director Comey, wants to make sure that this does not look suspicious, that this does not look underhanded. They want people to see that this is on the up and up.
Well, and a couple big questions, maybe more than two on the table, but one of them, did Russia influence the outcome of the election? Any answers or directions there yet?
Not really. I think what you saw today with Director Comey and also with Admiral Mike Rogers, who's the head of the National Security Agency, was these two senior officials saying it was not our purview, and in fact, we are not equipped to assess whether they affected the outcome, whether they changed the outcome. They were certainly clear that Russia did a lot to influence people's perceptions through this sort of hack and leak strategy. But I think what you're seeing is that they're being very careful not to suggest that what Russia did was determinative.
Did anything come as a big reveal, as a surprise today at this hearing?
Well, I guess I would say the thing that surprised me the most was that Director Comey said that the counterintelligence investigation, so the investigation around whether Russia had any assistance with its activities, that began last July, which, if you remember, was before the majority of the leaks, but after the Democratic National Committee hack had been announced. That's quite a long time ago, and what is important to me about that is Devin Nunes, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said today that he didn't know about that until a few weeks ago. He didn't know the extent of the investigation and when it began until a few weeks ago. That's significant to me because it raises the question of exactly why Director Comey or the officials reporting to him would not have told Congress or the top intelligence and party leaders the fact that that was happening as far back as July.
And did that why question ever get addressed or at least referred to?
No, Chairman Nunes brought it up after the hearing was over, that he had only just learned about it in recent weeks. And so I think what you're going to see is he'll be pressing officials from the FBI and from the Justice Department on exactly why that happened. And I would imagine a lot of that is going to happen through classified channels behind closed doors because, look, he's a Republican. He's leading an investigation that could touch on improper behavior by a Republican president, a Republican White House. This is an uncomfortable situation for him in the first place, and now he's learning that some pretty key details were not brought to him until just recently.
We're talking with Eric Geller right now from Politico Pro, and we're talking about the House Intelligence Committee hearing today about alleged Russian interference in the U.S. election. And I want to listen to a clip now. Here we'll hear Representative Adam Schiff, a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, asking James Comey about President Trump's claims that former President Barack Obama wiretapped Trump Tower. This was another issue that came up today.
Director Comey, was the president's statement that Obama had his wires tapped in Trump Tower a true statement?
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
So no information supporting wiretapping by former President Barack Obama of then-candidate Donald Trump. Does that put this to bed?
Oh, absolutely not. I think if there's one thing that we have learned about our new president is that he, once something is fixated in his head and once he believes that something has happened, very little is able to dissuade him from that. And I think you saw today from the White House, the press secretary, Sean Spicer, saying this is not over. They still want to understand exactly what happened with respect to surveillance of not just President Trump, but also Michael Flynn, who was for a time his national security advisor. They're being very clear that they don't consider this to be over.
And another interesting aspect of what happened today is that the president himself was tweeting during the hearing and commenting on it, providing his own sort of perspective. And he seemed focused during parts of this on the leaks, the classified leaks, and where they were coming from. How did that change things?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very interesting. We've never before had a sitting president or a staff member for him tweeting out what they consider to be takeaways from the hearing, only to have a lawmaker from the other party ask the witness, is this really a fair characterization of what you said? And to have that witness say, no, it isn't. And that's what happened with Director Comey. And I think it just sort of it injected this very a real and pressing element of people talking past each other and a certain belief that you can just characterize words in a certain way and that it won't matter if that's not necessarily accurate. That is a dynamic that we have seen play out over the course of the 2016 election and the beginning of the administration. And this particular instance of it, I think, really just made it clear both to the lawmakers and I think to Director Comey that this is not this phenomenon is not something that's going to go away, that the president will continue to do this as the investigation continues.
Now, Democrats, among other things, would like to tease out whether there was any coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. How do you expect that line of questioning to proceed, and who else do you think we might hear from?
Well, one person we're almost certainly going to hear from is Roger Stone, who was has been sort of an on-again, off-again advisor to the president, of course, before he was elected. Their relationship goes back a long time. He was an advisor to Trump during the campaign, and he has said that he really wants to be brought forward, to be brought in by the committees to testify. He tweeted basically during the hearing, essentially saying, you know, I'm being slandered right now. I ought to have my day, not my day in court, but I ought to have the opportunity to respond to these claims. So we're almost certainly going to hear from him. He's been sent a letter asking him to preserve any material that could be related to this. You know, we may also hear from Michael Flynn. We may also hear from another foreign policy advisor, a former foreign policy advisor, Carter Page. And, of course, we could hear from Paul Manafort, who was the Trump campaign chairman for a while and has had connections to pro-Russian Ukrainian individuals, including the former president who was ousted. That, of course, led to the Crimea annexation. So this is all sort of circling back to the foreign policy events that we've seen over the past few years. I will say I don't expect that line of inquiry, or I should say we don't necessarily have a lot of signs that line of inquiry is going to be fruitful, the collusion question. What we're hearing is there are a lot of people who were involved in the investigation in the FBI, in the various committees, who say we're worried that people are putting all their eggs in that basket, that collusion basket, and that if we can't turn up something that is frankly very, you know, that's the bombshell of all bombshells if that comes out. And then basically what they say is we're worried that if we don't find that, people are going to say, oh, well, no harm, no foul. That was the big question, and it was settled. There's no evidence of collusion, so we'll throw up our hand. And, you know, for those people who are working on the investigation, to them, just the fact that this interference occurred, that's a big deal. And just the fact that these conversations between Trump associates and Russian officials, just the fact that those conversations happened, that's also a big deal to them. So they're really worried that people are focusing too much on collusion. And I think we may see an attempt by the Democrats to maybe push a bit away from that so that the Republicans can't say, no harm, no foul, if we get to the point where we don't see collusion.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Eric Geller, cybersecurity reporter for Politico Pro. And he was with us there to talk about the House Intelligence Committee hearing today about alleged Russian interference in the U.S. election. You can hear more about today's House Intelligence Committee meeting tonight at 7 o'clock on the Ideas Network. You'll hear the latest updates from the hearing in We Got Hacked, Russia's Role in the U.S. Presidential Election. That's 7 o'clock tonight on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest tells us how to think critically in a post-truth era. Right now, it wasn't that long ago that a simple pedometer was the only real wearable fitness technology, but now everything from Fitbits to apps on smartphones track your steps, your heart rate, flights of stairs climbed, and even the quality of your sleep. But does all this cutting-edge technology make us healthier? A recent study says not necessarily. So we asked Regan Gurung why that might be. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and he joins us now from our Green Bay studios. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, some of these recent studies have looked at these fitness trackers and whether they help people lose weight or, on the other end, maybe just be more active. So in general, tell us, if you would, what they found.
So this is one of those wonderful situations where you go, you know, there's all this technology out there. It's part of something that's called the quantified self movement, where we try and measure every aspect of what we do. And, you know, you hit a lot of those things. How much are we sleeping? And, of course, a big one is how active are we? So for the last 4 or 5 years that these devices have been out there, and I should say those devices have been out there a little longer, but for the last 4 or 5 years, we've finally begun to see a number of studies that say, look, does having one of these fitness trackers actually do something? And there were a number of studies that said, well, you know, it doesn't seem to make a difference, but a lot of the studies that were out there had many methodological issues. They had small sample sizes. And then not too long ago, there was a very large study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and this was with authors out at the in Pittsburgh, and it was something called the IDEA trial. And this study was something that a lot of people paid attention to because it was a 2-year study, one of the longest studies done on something like this, with a really nice sample size. There were about 470 adults in it. And what they did was, firstly, they gave everybody advice on how to get active and how to lose weight. And then about midway through the study, they randomly selected half of that group and gave that half a wearable fitness tracker. And of course, the big question was, did the group who had this device do any better than the group that didn't? Now, there was good news and there's bad news. The good news was everybody in this study lost some weight and got more active. And that's a nice thing. That was what the study was about. And remember, everybody in the study got the same information on how to do it. The big question, though, is did the people who have those fitness devices actually lose more weight and were they more active? And the sad answer is, well, maybe sad is putting a value judgment on it, but the surprising answer is no. In fact, when the group that was wearing the devices lost on average 7.5 pounds, the group that didn't have the devices actually lost 13 pounds on average.
It kind of blows your mind, doesn't it? You think, well, I mean, I guess on one hand, you think that data is power. So if you have all these data points about how you're doing, surely you can use it to influence your behavior and be more successful. So what do you think happened, Regan?
Well, I think there's a number of things going on here. And in some ways, this is not too surprising in terms of how, when we think about just about anything that's out there for fitness. And, you know, I bet a good number of listeners have in their basements something that they bought to help them with fitness, and they used it when they first got it, and now it's just gathering dust. A fitness tracker is not that different. It's exciting. It's something new. Based on some of the ones that are out there, it's actually pretty a snazzy accessory on top of it all. And the biggest thing that it gives you is something that makes, I think, that makes what you're doing more visible and active and actually nudges you when you aren't doing something, right? So you would think, yes, it should happen. But the problem with all these different things is if it's the only thing that you're changing, it's not going to work. One of the biggest things health psychologists now know is that to keep motivation going, if you just change one element, if you don't change other things around with it, you're not going to keep it sustained. So I think a phrase for all of us to keep in mind is whatever change that we put in place, we've got to keep at it, whether it's more walking, whether it's running more or exercising more, whether it's watching what we eat. The bottom line is we've got to keep at it. And a fitness tracker is great at getting us starting to do something. You know, there's this big uptick in how active people are once they buy it, once they first use it, but it then drops out. And that's why if you ask me, what do you think is going on in this study here? The fact that it's a two-year study probably explains a lot of the issue. I would bet if we carved up that data into the first 6 months or the first year, we wouldn't see the same results as we would when you look at it over 2 years. People use the tracker a lot at the beginning, and then it drops off. So our big challenge is, as human beings who want to live healthier lives, is how do we keep at those healthy behaviors?
So it sounds like people may be tapered off, but it also sounded like you were suggesting that we zoom in on it too much and we get obsessed with it, and we, to the exclusion of other things, it may be just, or maybe even more important.
Well, you know, I think if we kept this question simple and said, do fitness trackers work? Well, the question is, what do you mean do they work? Do they measure your activity? Yes, they do. Will they actually make you lose weight? Well, not by themselves. You know, you can buy a great new pair of shoes and go, I'm going to start running next week. I've got this pair of shoes. But if you don't put those pair of shoes on and keep running with them, you're not going to get more physically active or physically fit. And I think a fitness tracker is something like that. It's a novel way. It's something that's, you know, it's great to check out all those things that it can do. But, you know, let's not forget that, you know, you can take one step back technology-wise. Most of the phones that all of us carry do a lot of the things that fitness trackers can do. And if it's a question of reminding you to get up and get active, you know, you can really go old school and use some Post-its. You know, you stick some Post-its around that say, hey, have you stood up? Don't you think it's time to take a walk? Way cheaper than Fitbits, you know?
I can never find Post-its when I need it.
My kids take most of mine.
We're talking to Regan Goering right now from UW Green Bay. He's a professor of human development and psychology. And we're talking about news, a couple of studies now that show that Fitbits are not seemingly so effective for helping us to get more fit or to lose weight. And Regan, another point that was brought up in a New York Times article about this topic was that, according to science, as it stands now at least, if you want to lose weight, you alter your diet. If you want to improve your health, you exercise. So it may be if people have weight loss goals, they're focusing maybe on the wrong thing. Do you think that's part of it?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, to expand that just a little bit, I think we've got to keep in mind there are three big things to keep in mind, both in terms of whenever you hear about a study like this and whenever you think about your own health. It's the three things are you male or female, how old are you, and how long are you planning on doing it? Because each of those three variables can make the world of a difference. Male and female physiology is slightly different. How we store fat is slightly different. Your age, boy, you know, as a person ages, how they store fat and how they metabolize fat changes. So in this study that I talked about, it's important to state that the age range was the 18 to 35-year-old. So if you are not in that age range, to some extent, those findings from the study don't generalize to you as well. And I think this is important because you mentioned the New York Times article. The BBC has also been doing some studies, some reporting on this. And when I look at a lot of the different studies that are mentioned, I noticed a lot of the studies are done on a very different age group, the 60 to 75-year-old. Hmm. So if you're not paying attention to the sample age, and let's say you're 21, well, that study that's done on a 60 to 75-year-old male and you're a 21-year-old woman, there's a lot of physiological differences in terms of the metabolic system and so on that, you know, just aren't the same. So there's really a lot to keep in mind before you just take one of those studies and go, oh, gosh, that was, you know, money not well spent.
So does it work better if you're older?
Well, it's actually easier for younger individuals to get their metabolic system going. When you're older, Our metabolic system doesn't do what it used to do when we were younger. People will notice that even if they keep most things about the same, their eating habits, their physical activity habits, they will start putting on weight.
Yeah, that's just not fair.
It's tell me about it. That's just a very natural way to go. So I think what's important is, you know, really getting that physical activity going. And you know, watch for, you know, before you jump out and follow something, watch where that recommendation's coming from. My favorite is the 10,000 steps. One study in 1960 in Japan showed that the average number of steps Japanese men took to burn 3,000 calories was 10,000. One study, 1960. And because of that one study, everybody throws around the "gotta get my 10,000 steps in." So don't get me wrong, 10,000 steps, that's great. But you know what? For some of us, 10,000 steps are not enough. For others, we don't need 10,000 steps. So again, watch those, you know, before we jump on and say, oh, it's helping me get my 10,000 steps. Well, put things in place to get you active. Put things in place to get you active. And again, that phrase, keep at it. You know, what can you do to your life, to your lifestyle that'll help you keep at a behavior change, whether it's increasing activity or watching what you eat. And, you know, going back to what your original question, yep, those two things are really important. We can't just change one thing and think that things will magically happen for us.
And Ricky, we're just about out of time, but a lot of people have these things already. If they have them, what should they do? Should they throw them out or sell them? You know,
no,
or should
absolutely
they keep
not. I think for those folks listening who have it, I really hope you're using it. If you haven't used it in a long time, dust it off and put things into place to make sure that you can keep at it. Because Fitbits are a great way to make sure it to remind you how active you are, but you've got to keep doing it. You can't just do it for a while and stop. So, folks, keep at it. Put things into place. What those things are, I guess that's a whole nother day.
Regan, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate your time.
You bet.
That was Regan Gurung, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He joined us from our Green Bay studios to talk about the effectiveness of devices like Fitbits. Coming up after the news, a neuroscientist tells us how to practice critical thinking in a world of fake news, bad data, and half-truths. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, half of dairy producers rely on immigrant workers. We take a look at Wisconsin's dairy industry and how it may already be changing under the Trump administration. First, terms like fake news, alternative facts, and post-truth became catchphrases in the 2016 election campaign and its aftermath, and fact-checking exploded as part of mainstream journalism. Our next guest is worried that we as a society are giving up on the idea of facts and truth and giving in to an ever-increasing flow of lies on social media and in our political system. He says we need to rebuild our critical thinking skills and get better at sorting out the truth from the lies. Daniel Levitin joins us now. He's a neuroscientist, dean of arts and humanities at the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Schools, and a distinguished faculty fellow at the University of California, Berkeley. His newest book is called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Daniel, you're not crazy about this idea of living in a post-truth world. You don't think we should accept it, but are we already there?
Well, no, I'm not willing to throw in the logical towel yet. I object to, you know, look, I think words matter, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a professor and it's my job. I mean, we've gone to war over words and misunderstandings, and a lot of hatred in this country is expressed through words. And when I hear somebody say use a term like fake news or alt truth or alternative facts, I think that it lowers the level of conversation, making it more stupid and making it harder for the rest of us to talk about reality.
Well, what should it be called?
Well, I wouldn't call let's take them one at a time. There is no such thing as alternative facts. A fact is something that exists in reality, and it's either true or it's not. There can be alternative views about what to do about a fact, right? We can agree what the facts are, but we might have different approaches as a society about how to deal with unemployment or climate change, just to pick two. The problem I have with the term fake news is that it sounds a little too benign. I think that we should call it what it is. It's a lie. You know, fake news dignifies it as a variety or flavor of news, but it's not news at all.
So as a journalist, if someone is reporting the news, for instance, you write about the shooting at a D.C. pizza parlor that was targeted because someone had read an article that you would call a lie, saying that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of this pizza parlor, and then there was this shooting. So as a journalist, how would you report that? I think that might be where it gets a little sticky.
Well, you're a journalist. How would you want to handle something like that? Right? There are phases of it where at first you hear the story about Hillary Clinton running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in suburban Washington, D.C., and maybe you read about it, but you're not willing to talk about it on Wisconsin Public Radio until you can get it confirmed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody were to ask you about it, what would you say?
Well, as a newscaster, though, I think that's where I'm not a newscaster, but to say the story, I guess you could just say the story was a lie.
Yeah, or you could say, you know, there's no evidence for the story. And then you could talk about how implausible it is. if you know anything about Hillary Clinton, you know that she gets these enormous speaking fees. She gets like $500,000 to give a talk. And, you know, she brought in millions and millions of dollars. Whether you're pro or anti-Hillary is not the issue. But, you know, resorting to an illegal activity in a child sex slave ring seems really far-fetched if you can just go out and talk for an hour.
And so what do you think has changed that we have all of these, you know, this proliferation of terms like that? We have fake news, we have fringe theories, and, you know, it used to be, I was taught critical thinking in school, in grade school. Is that something that we've lost track of?
I think we have. I think two things have happened. The teaching of critical thinking somehow became, it seemed fusty or old-fashioned, and so we stopped doing it. And I think we should go back to it. We don't have to call it that. We could call it evidence-based thinking, if you like. But basically, going through a mental checklist, you know, like, is the claim plausible? Does it come from a good source? Are we hearing from an expert on the topic or only an amateur? These kinds of things, right? Is the data we're being presented even relevant to the issue? And I think the other problem is that in an effort to get along better in a multicultural society, we've adopted polite and delicate speech about a number of things, which I think is great. I'm not against that. But I think in an effort to avoid offending people, rather than calling it a lie, we call it fake news or alt-truth. And I say, if somebody's lying to you, go ahead and offend them.
We're talking with Daniel Levitin right now. He's a neuroscientist, and he's got a new book out. It's called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And he says we're overcome right now with lies of one form or another. And he's got some advice about how to evaluate what we hear and what we read. And Daniel, let's get into some of those ways that we can evaluate different claims. You talk about, for instance, numbers, statistics. What should we think about before we just take them in and stamp them true and move on?
Well, the thing to remember about statistics and numbers is that they're not facts. They can represent facts, but in and of themselves, many of us are intimidated by them. There's an air of precision and accuracy to a number, but we have to ask ourselves some, you know, I think basic and logical questions when we encounter numbers, such as, are they plausible? Where did they come from? Here's one. Do you recall hearing the claim that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate?
I do, yeah.
Now, it turns out that's true. 4 out of 5 dentists do recommend Colgate. But when I hear a claim like that, there's a bunch of questions I would want to know more about this. For one thing, who are these dentists? Are they dentists who still have their licenses? Are they on the Colgate payroll? And did they really ask just five, or did they ask 500 and, you know, 400 of them? And what about this fifth dentist? What's the fifth dentist recommending? But you can go deeper than that. And Colgate was actually sued for this claim because I think in the popular mind, and this is a lapse of critical thinking on our part, and it's not Colgate's fault, but I think they exploited it. In our mind, when we hear that four out of five dentists recommend Colgate, we complete the phrase with, to the exclusion of other toothpastes. And that's not at all what was going on. So when I encounter a statistic or a number, what I am hoping the journalist will tell me is more about how the number was arrived at. And in the Colgate case, the dentists were simply asked to list as many toothpastes as they wanted to that they would recommend. And so now you've got them recommending Colgate, but they're also recommending Gleam and Aquafresh and AIM and Crest and all the rest, Arm & Hammer. So Colgate lost the suit, and they can no longer make the claim.
And, yeah, that it's true from a particular perspective, and it sounds as though you had to do a little legwork to arrive at the data that you found about the 4 out of 5 dentist claim. So is that part of it, that we do have to maybe accept that we have to do sometimes a little homework?
I'm afraid so. The good news here is that the kind of homework we need to do doesn't take long. And when you consider how much time we save by having this great thing called the Internet, which just delivers any fact we want, you know, to our pocket within a minute, all the time we're saving by not having to trudge to a library or go to some far-flung archive, we can invest in trying to figure out whether the Internet is giving us information that's true or not. So, I mean, it's just a different way to use the time. You know, there's another thing about that dentist's claim.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not drilling down too hard on this.
No, go ahead.
You see what I did there, drilling down?
Well done.
I have a particular beef about pseudo-experts, people who are not really expert in the thing they're pontificating about. And I don't know about you, but I've been going to a dentist my whole life, and my dentist has never asked me what toothpaste I use. And there's always somebody in the chair in the room next to me, and I've never heard him asking the other people. I'm not sure that a dentist is the appropriate expert.
Wow.
I think that what you need is a medical researcher who randomly assigns toothpastes to people, different toothpastes, and then follows them for a few years and see who's got the better oral health outcomes. That's who you should be asking. And there are studies done, you know, by medical researchers, but that's not what Colgate cited, is it?
No, they didn't. I think also that people, I mean, you trust the person who is in that position of power. You know, as we kind of wrap up to get to calls, though, I mean, how do you evaluate an expert, Daniel? If it's not a dentist, which seems obvious, how do you go about evaluating these other experts?
Well, I would say it doesn't take that much. It just takes a little bit of independent thought. Just take a breath and think: is a dentist really the right expert? Or in any case, you know, like with climate change, a number of the scientists who were voicing opinions about it, for or against, are not climatologists. They're not trained in climate science. You've got people who are electrical engineers or geneticists, and you know it's not their field. You know, if you need heart surgery, you don't go to a podiatrist. We understand some of this. The rest of it's just a bit of common sense, I would say.
We're talking with Daniel Levitin right now about his new book, Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's getting harder and harder to separate truth from lies with all the claims that maybe you see online? Have you given up, or do you have suggestions on how you sort things out successfully, or questions for our guest? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Daniel Levitin is with us. He's a neuroscientist, and his new book is called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. How do you try to sort out the truth from the lies as you look at social media, you follow the news, or when you listen to a politician? And what questions do you have for our guest? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Bruce joining us in Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to the show, and I really like what I heard so far, but I've said for a long time now, many years, that people have opinions, and they assume the premises that that's the truth, whereas it's just an opinion. There's some opinions are not based in fact. They're just, you know, kind of like if you like a movie or not, but they kind of slide over to things about actual, you know, like global warming. You know, everybody has an opinion, but that doesn't make it true or false.
Right, Bruce. Go ahead, Daniel.
I really like this distinction you're making, Bruce, and I remember back to being in elementary school. I was part of the group of kids that they experimented with what they called the new math, if that rings any bells for listeners, and it tells you that I'm about 60 years old, too. But one of the things I remember in elementary school is they would give us statements, and we would have to say, is that opinion or fact? And, you know, it was rapid fire, and this went on for months. And I agree with the caller, Bruce, that we've gotten to a point where we don't make that distinction as readily, and it sometimes hijacks our thought process. As the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan quipped, I think it's absolutely true, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you aren't entitled to your own facts.
And I think what Bruce is getting at, too, is that when something is a belief that we hold very dear to our heart, or maybe it's part of our core identity, you can throw as many facts as you want, and they're all going to bounce right off.
That's a whole other issue, Veronica, and it's a vexing one. Because somebody who's made up their mind emotionally about something, as you just so insightfully pointed out, is not going to be tipped from their position by a rational argument. And that's where we can run into a lot of trouble as a society, you know, in the political process, trying to make some headway and find solutions to the problems that face us.
Well, Bruce, thanks a lot for the call and for bringing that up. And we go next to Tim in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to be very politically incorrect here and mention something I've never heard in this discussion. And I was a reading specialist for 35 years, taught in high school. Maybe, just maybe, there are an awful lot of people who just are not intelligent enough to do any reasoning.
And that's a pretty controversial thing to say. And Daniel, what do you say to that as an educator?
Well, there's some data on this, fortunately. A group of researchers, cognition researchers, have come up with something called the rationality quotient, or RQ. And it runs alongside the IQ, the intelligence quotient. And it turns out that, you know, there is a way to rate a person's rationality. And it turns out that the rationality quotient is not at all related to the IQ, that people who are very high in IQ can have a low RQ and vice versa. And I've devoted my life to education, and I can tell you one of the great things about it is that it's equal opportunity. It's not the case that only the smart kids learn things in a classroom. Kids all along that axis are capable of learning things if they've got good teachers.
So in other words, rationality can be taught.
I believe, yes. I believe that rationality can be taught. I've seen it. That's what science education and legal education and journalism education is about, isn't it?
Well, thank you for that call. And now we're going to go to Nancy in Sussex. Nancy, hello.
Hi. Hi. I'm a reading teacher, and one of the things that I have found is I have children that are able to read but not understand what they read. They're not able to infer. They're not able to really comprehend what the words and things that they're saying mean. There are absolute truths, and there are truths that go beyond reason that can be proven. But what I think happens is people distort those truths based on their own comprehension and their own views versus what's real on the page and what it's meant to be. So I think sometimes the distortion comes from people's own personal views and not necessarily the fact that is told by a story and the way in which you infer its meaning and understand what it's supposed to be.
Nancy, can I ask how old the children are that you're working with?
I work with a range of children from kindergarten to high school. And what I find is that for many children, critical thinking comes at the point of inferring. In other words, they can read information. They have to have enough background and real information to be able to figure out if what they're reading is real or not. And I find that there are many times where children can read all the words and they're fluent and able to do what they're supposed to do, but yet when you ask them a question about what it was about, the theme, the idea, many times they can't tell you. So the truth comes in that fact that some people can really understand what they read and are told, and some people can infer what all the other pieces are that come into the meaning of what is being said or read.
Nancy, thank you for that. And Daniel, do you agree? Do we need some kind of baseline knowledge to make inferences and grasp more complex reasoning processes?
I think we learn to inference by example, by parents and teachers who model it for us, public figures. And I think we learn through education, through being taught how to inference, by being taught to make simple inferences and then more and more complex ones. Again, that's really what law school is about. And for those of us who have been following the federal court judge decisions relating to President Trump's various executive orders, the interesting thing is that from my perspective, I'm saying this as a citizen, not as a neuroscientist. I'm not testifying as an expert on the political process, but it seems to me the judges are just looking at the evidence. They don't have a political agenda, and in some cases they're finding that the evidence is lacking. And I think this is a triumph of a system that's working the way it was supposed to work. An independent judiciary weighs the evidence dispassionately. They are not making any inferences. They're making deductions based on the data that's in front of them.
Nancy, thank you for that call. And Daniel, I want to ask you about the critical thinking piece of it. Now, it sounds like you think that this is something we can learn at any age. We don't have to just get it in school. That would be helpful. What are some concrete steps that we can take right now, today, to get to where you're talking about?
Well, I mean, this is why I wrote the book. I don't think that my book is the only book that does this. There are other good books like Charles Wieland's Naked Statistics. There's a good book called Counter Knowledge. There's the old book from the 1950s called How to Lie with Statistics. You can probably pick that up for a dollar at the used bookstore. I'm not here to sell books. That seems kind of trivial compared to the larger message of getting people on board. But I did write the book to put all these ideas in one place, and one of them is plausibility. Is a claim plausible? Hillary Clinton doing a risky thing like operating a child sex slave ring just does not seem plausible. Or here's another one. It was claimed that in the 35 years since California stopped enforcing marijuana laws, the number of marijuana smokers in that state doubled every year. Now, you don't have to spend more than about 15 seconds and just do a quick calculation to realize that if you double, if you start with one marijuana smoker 35 years ago and you double the number one 35 times, you end up with 17 billion, which is more than the population of the earth. So the claim isn't plausible. And you can dispense with a lot of stuff as nonsense if, you know, very early on in the process if you find it's not plausible.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Veronica.
That was neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. He is a fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, a distinguished faculty fellow, I should say. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's called Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And you can let us know how you get that done, how you think critically, what's worked for you, where you go to find trusted sources, to fact check things. Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Musician extraordinaire Chuck Berry died this weekend at the age of 90. According to the New York Times, Mr. Berry was rock and roll's master theorist and conceptual genius, the songwriter who understood what the kids wanted before they knew it themselves. Journalist Joe Queenan writes that Berry had the habit of showing up for gigs with a local band that he'd hired for cheap without any rehearsals. And Bruce Springsteen actually fronted one of those bands once when he was in town and noted that Berry had what he called an annoying habit of switching to a really hard key in the middle of a song. Well, you have to hear that story and kind of guess that the song probably wasn't that hard for Berry, and any key change was something he could handle. So even though he wasn't from New Orleans and he wasn't short on education like his character Johnny B. Goode, he could for sure play a guitar like he was ringing a bell.